All right, my name is Bruce, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's funny, I asked a couple people any suggestions, and this will give you a sense of kind of, you know, what most people think of me. They said, well, and this was a consistent thing, everybody that I asked, any suggestions? Keep it light. So, you know, because I can get down, you know, so I hope I do keep it light, and I hope I do make this about, you know, I'm going to try to do it just like everybody says, you know, the way it used to be, what happened, and the way it is today. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is really more about hope than it is about all the problems, you know. And if there's a message that I hope I can communicate today is that most of the quote-unquote problems in my life are as simple as mistaken beliefs. You know, and if I really begin to look back in my life, and this was kind of a cool thing for me because, you know, I decided to take some risks today, you know, to actually be who I am, you know, and I don't do that all the time, you know. I'm pretty good at, like, well, you know, you can do this and you can do that, and I can tell you about all the things that I've done after I've solved a problem, but sometimes exposing myself in the midst of struggle isn't the easiest thing for me to do. So, that's a little prelude. Danny gave me a joke. He said, you can start off with something like, you guys look pretty good naked. You know, I don't know if anybody gets that joke. So, you know, it's like, I'm naked up here and I'm looking out at you guys. Okay. So, anyway, that, you can blame Danny on that. So. Okay. You know, I know it's early in the morning, so, you know, the humor has to go with it. You know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with kind of some early stuff because I think the seeds of my alcoholism were planted well before I picked up the first drink. You know, I can't really remember this, so I can only kind of go by, you know, kind of a feeling and kind of what I've heard from my parents and that kind of thing. But I think I was one of these kids that was pretty connected to my mom, you know, pretty, you know, sensitive, blah, 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 and, you know, pretty connected to my mom. And, you know, I really didn't want to go to school. You know, this school stuff is bullshit. Why do I need to go to school, Mom? You know, I really just want to stay home with you. And, you know, I think kind of from this early age, I began to realize that for me to succeed in life, I had to really shut off my feelings. You know, it hurt, you know, and it wasn't okay to hurt, you know, and a lot of the things that I experienced in my early life were, you know, I thought growing up meant shutting off the way I felt, you know, and the older I got, the more successful I got at shutting out the way I felt, you know, and I could be pretty stoic, you know. You could say whatever you want to me and I'm not going to react because, you know, basically, you know, I don't feel a whole lot, you know. And another kind of early memory I have is even though we lived in the same place, the area that I grew up in, Cincinnati, Ohio, and we were in a really growing area, a lot of people moving, blah, 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 blah. And so they were busing people and schools were being built and lots of dynamic things were happening. So it happened that from third grade through seventh grade, I was in a different school every year. And, you know, I knew that going into the summer, right, I was going to be in a different school every year. And so I had all year to project, you know, all summer to project, you know, how that was going to be. And so the result for me was, you know, from third grade through seventh grade, every first day of school, I got sick. You know, and sometimes it was really embarrassing and sometimes it was less embarrassing. But the reality was, you know, I had this fear inside of me and I had this sense that I didn't fit in and what would they think and blah, 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 blah. And I didn't have any way to deal with it, you know. And, you know, and I was raised in a, you know, an environment where I went to church and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, one of the ways I survived was by overcompensating. You know, I would be good at things, you know, because you had a lot of power. I didn't have a whole lot of power, but you had a lot of power. And if I could get you to feel a particular way about me, then that gave me some power. You know, it gave me a sense of I was being okay. So if I was a real good student, you know, then I would get an attaboy, and I liked attaboys, and I wanted all that kind of support. So, yeah, I was able to succeed in school, you know, pretty well. But I had a lot of trouble with the social parts of it. You know, how do I really reach out? How do I become a friend to other kids? You know, I mean, I had some close friends, but it was not easy for me to feel a part of. I felt very separated, very distinct, very unique, very different. You know, this whole church thing, you know, if I'm honest about it, church was no more than another class for me. It was another way to perform, you know. I go and I listen, and what am I going to be quizzed on? Oh, okay, well, cool, I know that. And what am I supposed to believe? Wow, I can spit that out. And so it was just... And then the older I got, the more church felt like Santa Claus, you know. Believe a bunch of stuff that doesn't make sense, and just like Santa Claus, it becomes useless, you know. You grow out of it, you know. And I kind of saw myself growing out of whatever this church was that was teaching me stuff. So, you know, I find myself, you know, a teenager. I've got my little identity, you know, as a good student, you know, somebody that could succeed in school. I was able to survive without a lot of connection, you know. I could isolate, and in truth, I saw most of my problems as being outside. You know, one of my favorite things I can remember as a kid, I had a little rock, you know. I used to call it my thinking rock. And, you know, I didn't want to be disturbed when I was on my rock, you know. And my favorite little phrase to whoever was, you know, trying to get me to do something was, leave me alone. And I wanted to be left alone. And I felt like I could solve things if I was alone. And I felt like that was what growing up was all about, was how do I survive by being self-reliant? How do I survive without feeling? How do I survive without some kind of faith? Because that was a bunch of, you know, make-believe. And in its own way, as I was growing in my teenage years, my life was becoming kind of shallower and shallower, narrow and narrow. You know, there was, and I knew I was missing things, but I was good at denial, man. And that's I believe that a core competence of most alcoholics is denial. You know, and I believe we learn it at an early age. And, you know, I was pretty good at denying anything. You know, if you looked at me, I could put on a great act about how great things were, or this, that, and the other thing. But inside, there was a real sense of emptiness, a real sense of being alone. So I'm 15 years old. You know, I'm beginning to drink a little bit. You know, I really... It's not like I get this great, you know, high from just the little bit of drinking that I'm doing. But I make a decision that, you know, I'm gonna really go for it. You know, I'm going to really get wasted. And that was an incredibly positive experience. Incredibly positive. You know, all the things that I was looking for began to show up in my life, you know, and I felt as if I had found the solution, you know, and I can remember really vividly. See, I never really understood people that didn't black out and stuff like that, because when I drank, I blacked out most of the time. And, you know, that first time I remember blacking out, you know, I don't remember blacking out, but I remember that the next day I people were telling me, you know, how much fun I was and how much, you know, how different I was. And it was like I could be this Jekyll and Hyde. I could be this serious thing, and then, you know, I could turn on this other part of me that was like a whole different person that could come alive when I began to drink. And man, it was great. You know, I had all these people, I had these new connections, pretty good dancer, people were telling me, and I was like, wow, you know, cool. I also began to have a faith. You know, I had a faith now, because I had something that could fix me. And I put faith in this thing. And I can remember really clearly, you know, despite having a terrible hangover the next day, planning my next drunk. You know, it was like, okay, when are we going to do this again? You know, and that was important to me. When are we going to do this again? Because I want to feel this way again. I want to feel like I'm okay, and I want to feel like I'm whole, and I want to feel like I'm full, and I want to feel like, and see, the other thing that was cool about it is I could kind of do it without, you know, the connections would kind of come through the drinking. I didn't have to put a lot of energy into the connections outside of that, you know, and so it was kind of like, you know, and that really began the pattern for me, you know, in my life. So I identify a lot with kids, you know, who struggle with addiction, because that was for me a lot of the roots. And like I said, it was very much a solution for me. It was not a problem. And I could get lots of support from people saying it was a solution for me too. You know, it made me a lot of the person that I wanted to be. So, you know, things progressed. I was continuing to do pretty well in school. I was having this, you know, new thing happen. You know, everything was good. Got into college. College was even better because now I wasn't limited to probably just one night a week to get wasted. It could be greatly expanded, okay? And there were lots of people that were willing to join me in this particular endeavor, you know, and it was a good time. I was very much a, kind of two different people. And see, that's one of the things, you know, not to diverge too much, but, you know, a lot of people, when they heard, you know, Bill Clinton and the whole Monica Lewinsky thing talk about compartmentals, you know, I can relate to that, man. That was my life, too. I had these little compartments. And the truth was, I was really pretty good at hiding compartments, not only from you, but also from me. You know, it's kind of like I was this person here, I was this person over here. And no one really kind of saw all of it. And so I could really, you know, kind of mask a lot of who I was and what I was up to. So in college then it began, you know, that's when, you know, drugs are a part of my story, okay? And that's when drugs became, you know, a great addition to, you know, this connection. And see, for me, they really elevated, you know, the whole connection and the whole kind of delusion of what I was all about. And so I could begin, you know, I really kept my schedule pretty much so I would work Monday, you know, go to school Monday through Thursday. Thursday night through Saturday, man, you know, I could go for it. And I could kind of straighten myself up, function again on Sunday, you know, and that was my life. So I get out of college, get a decent job. You know, I haven't dealt with any of these underlying issues. I'm still the same guy that was throwing up, you know, in third grade, man, emotionally, okay? And I'm still, you know, the lack of faith, other than in drugs and alcohol, the sense of self-reliance, you know, that this is all about how can I do this by myself. All those things are still, that's who I am. So the one request I had when I took this job was do not send me to New York, because being a Midwestern guy, man, I'm kind of petrified of New York, if the truth be known. You know, all kinds of wild stuff goes on in New York, and I knew I could get in some serious trouble. And so what they send me to New York, you know. So so despite the fact that I think I was probably full of fear, man, I was bulletproof, you know. And my addiction began to really take hold when I was in New York. It became a lot harder for me to hide some of the problem. I can remember having no intention of getting drunk. You know, I'm going out on a business meeting with my boss, my boss's boss, and his boss, okay? So, you know, supposed to kind of have it together. You know, and I'm throwing up at the table by the end of the night, you know? And, you know, the sense of how do you face these people the next day? How do you act like it's okay? You know, and yeah, they were able to kind of excuse it, and you know, I was drinking Rusty Nails, and I haven't been used to drinking Rusty Nails. Man, I won't do that again. You know, I had my little BS, you know, routine, but you know, the seed is planted that man, this guy's not got it all together. So, you know, I got transferred back to Cincinnati from this job. And then I began the process of identifying, again, the problem has nothing to do with me. It's all this stuff outside of me. So this job is a problem, man. This job really is a problem. And I got to fix that problem. So I got to quit this job. And, you know, what I need, I have been working way too hard for way too long. What I need is to kick back. So I buy a van and, you know, I just start traveling. And mainly what I'm doing is going from where can I get, you know, various kinds of things that I want to get my hands on, you know, from one part of the, you know, went all the way up to Maine, went all the way down to Key West. I'm doing kind of little odd jobs, doing whatever I got to do. But mainly it's about just feeding, you know, feeding this ability to get wasted whenever I wanted, you know, in whatever manner I wanted. And at a certain point, you know, I find myself with a lot of people I'm hanging with that are not the kind of people I'm used to hanging with, you know. I find myself with guys that are, you know, they're carrying guns and they're threatening me if I don't do this, and you know, a lot of situations that if you had told me, you know, even 6 months before that, Bruce, you're going to be dealing with this kind of stuff, I'd say, nah, that's not going to happen, you know. So I'm in a lot of different places that I got no business being in, but I'm there anyway. And all of a sudden, what I'm beginning to kind of adopt this new philosophy of life. And this philosophy really is, I'd rather burn out than fade away. You know, and, you know, the people that can't accept me for who I am, you know, they got a problem. And who I am is, I didn't really have a problem with letting you know that, you know, I like to drink and I like to do drugs. I had a problem with you thinking there was a problem with that, you know. And I wanted to just do what I wanted to do, and if you had a problem with it, tough. And I wanted to be kind of in your face with it to a degree. And so, you know, I ran out of money, and I got sick of working these lousy jobs, so I decided to go back to Cincinnati, found another job, and then got transferred from Cincinnati after a little while down to Atlanta. And I got this, you know, and I've had a couple of, I mean, some of these jobs are like really responsible jobs, you know, and I'm like totally irresponsible. And so how do I deal with this? And I don't deal with it very well. So this job I get down here, I'm supposed to be managing like 20 people, and I got, you know, I'm a mess. I'm a total mess. I begin, you know, my mind is all screwed up from all the stuff I'm doing. I'm trying to function. I'm trying to stay, you know, stay in some kind of equilibrium. I start, you know, here's my great coping mechanism. I start carrying around a razor blade, you know, and I feel, and I actually start cutting myself. It's like, you know, I would be in my office at work and I would hide under the desk, you know, because I didn't want to face the people out there or the things out there. And, you know, it was a crazy place. And, you know, the addiction was making it very difficult for me to function. And so, again, I'm looking for escapes, you know. I made a choice that wasn't a real wise choice. This is back in 81. You know, I make the choice that, okay, I'd had a terribly, I mean, I was just out of control one weekend. I'm supposed to be flying to Tampa, and man, I'm a mess. There's no way I can fly. And so I decide kind of impulsively, what I need to do is check into the mental institution. And so I go to Bronner. I don't know if any of you guys remember Bronner. Bronner was out in, you know. So I decide, that's a good solution. Let's check into Bronner. So, man, as soon as I check into Bronner, man, my objective becomes very clear. I got to get the hell out of here. I got to get out of here quick. But the good thing about Bronner was I was forced to take a look at my addiction, you know, and I was forced to go to some AA meetings. And of course, I hated it. I thought it was crap. I thought these people were brainwashed. I thought there was no way this could help me, you know, and there was always somebody that I would listen to that was worse off than I was, and I could feel better about myself. I'm not that bad. You know, if I was that bad, maybe this would make sense. But I could always find somebody. And by the way, I was always really good at surrounding myself with somebody that was worse than me so that I could make myself feel better. You know, if I was that bad, man, I'd be in trouble. But I'm better than that, see? And so there's always kind of that way of comparing myself to somebody and not really seeing myself honestly for who I am and for what I am. The next thing that begins to happen is the consequences start getting more serious for me. I quit that job. I find a job that's a much better job for me because I'm not trying to manage people. I'm getting off into something that I can really isolate myself in, which I'm pretty good at, and that's computers. You know, computers are new at this point, personal computers. I'm able to get a job writing software, and I like writing software, and it's kind of fun. And you know, I kind of think of this creative thing. I can get high and, you know, write software, and wow, what a cool expansion of my identity. And, you know, I'm working with a lot of young people, and we're having a lot of fun. And, you know, and so, you know, this is kind of a little rejuvenation again, this kind of helps confirm that the problem really was I just in the wrong job. You know, I now that I found the right job, I'm going to be okay. Well, you know, a lot of these people, you know, got sick of me, you know, and they got sick of the kind of things I was doing. And I would find myself, I was one of these guys that I had no ability, you know, the book talks about basic instincts, you know, we got these basic instincts and the problem is they go awry. Well, see, a lot of my basic instincts, they were only able, in my mind, to be addressed while I was drunk. You know, like this idea of having a relationship with a woman, man, I didn't know how to do that. You know, I knew how to have one night stands, and I knew how to try to get a one night stand, and you know that kind of stuff. But the relationship idea was like this kind of foreign concept, and so there were a lot of things, basic instincts that I had that I really had no good outlet for, and so I, you know, the consequences began to get more serious. I got a DUI, okay, and I can remember, you know, calling my buddies to bail me out. And so, again, very intelligent solution to my problem. You know, so I'm picked up at 6 in the morning. The solution is we start smoking pot, exclusively marijuana, okay? We got to stop drinking. That drinking is getting me in trouble, you know? And so those were the kinds of bizarre ways I had of dealing with my problems. I'm in this job, and I'll kind of, you know, keep it moving to get to more of the solution here. I finally get a person who I respect and I care about, who's my boss, and she, you know, I tell her, you know, I'm quitting my job, I'm traveling again, and I'm looking for another geographic cure. And then she challenges me, and she gets in my face, and she makes me wake up a little bit. And I check in to a treatment center, and I'm about to check out of that treatment center. I'm out the door of the treatment center because I really think this is BS. And I get out the door and I realize, I think for the first time in my life, that the way I would describe myself is a professional cynic. In other words, I can tell you all the stuff that I don't believe, but I had nothing to hold on to. You know, I had just, in my mind, proven that there was no God, and this idea of a higher power is a bunch of crap. And then I walk out, and what do I got? I got nothing to live on, man. I got nothing to live on. I got nothing to go from where I am, you know, anyplace else. And so at that particular moment, I hit some kind of a reality. And I began, for the first time, I think in a long, long time, to be willing to do something that made no sense to me because I didn't have an answer. This doesn't make sense to me, you know, but I started following instructions, you know, and their instructions were really pretty simple. You got to stay in this program, you know, you got to go to halfway house, you got to follow the rules of the halfway house, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I began to learn how to live that way, and I experienced a relationship with a higher power, you know, because that I couldn't stop drinking and using. I, you know, I'll just quickly, the physical problems may not have been as bad as a lot of people. I mean, I don't remember having tremendous problems with the shakes and all that, but I had these terrible headaches, and I couldn't sleep, you know, if I wasn't doing something. You know, I had to do something to sleep, and I had to do something to get rid of these headaches, and it always involved, you know, drugs and alcohol. And, you know, I couldn't imagine my life having any possibility without it. You know, I just couldn't envision that happening. And I can remember sincerely praying that serenity prayer time after time after time. And really, you know, really for the first time in my life, realizing that there was a higher power that was giving me something that I couldn't give myself. That was removing this obsession for me to drink and use, you know. And I did believe that. And I did begin to work towards that relationship a little bit. Now, I'd love to tell you that that's the end of my story, you know, and, you know, kumbaya, everything's great, and I've been, you know, I've got 20 plus years of sobriety and blah, 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 okay? Well, that's not the end of my story, okay? What happened to me was, again, I had all these things that I really hadn't figured out, but I'm still looking for all the answers on the outside, not on the inside. And so I've got a solution to my, you know, drug and alcohol problem, you know? God's removed it. I wanted to work, you know, and I did, you know, some work. I did the halfway house. I did a three-quarter way house for a portion of the time. But all of a sudden, I was starting to change, a little bit at least, and people were starting to come into my life. And, you know, one person in particular, you know, was starting to come into my life. And she, you know, seemed to like me, and she was pretty, you know, good-looking and pretty cool. And she wanted me to move in with her. And I was like, okay, wow, this is pretty cool. So, you know, I moved in with her, and all of a sudden, you know, I wanted to kind of have it both ways. I really didn't want to put all this energy into my sobriety. I wanted to stop drinking, stop using, and I wanted to start pursuing all these other things. I wanted to get the relationship. I wanted to make some serious money. I really wanted to have a family. I wanted to have kids. You know, I was awake that much that I wanted to kind of, and I figured if I started getting all these things in my life is going to be great. Okay? Now, I don't tell this, you know, all the time, but I haven't had a drink since July 1st, 1984, but I don't use that as my sobriety date, okay? My sobriety date is November 23rd, 1999. And the reason for that is because I didn't work the program for all that time. I was, for the most part, a dry drunk. I was full of anger. I had no sense of integrity. You know, I can remember, the who became my wife, she said, listen, you know, I don't want people calling you, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, okay, fine. You know, I'm going to do it the way she wants me to do it, you know. And it didn't have to, you know, it didn't have to be a priority in my life. And so I was managing to do it that way. And then it started, you know, a lot of ways, if you looked on me from the outside, you know, pretty good job, living in the suburbs, you know, doing all that kind of stuff, three kids, you know, all that kind of outside stuff. But inside, I'm still that angry, lonely, you know, human being. And, you know, this denial that we talk about, I'm going to read you something that I read, that I wrote a while back, that I don't know if anybody else can relate to it, but the title was, you know, called Feelings. I shut out the ones I thought would hurt. Why feel the pain? Just bury them in the dirt. And when that fails, you can run and hide, stay busy doing, always moving, and pretend it isn't real. But somewhere in the denial web I weave, I'm no longer able to control who I deceive. I become a lie and desperately aware of the emptiness and anger I always feel. You know, and that's where I was, man. And that's where I was November 23rd, 1999. And I didn't know at that point whether I was going to live or I was going to die, you know, truthfully. I was seriously thinking about just, you know, checking out. And I decided to go back to the clubhouse where I first got sober back in 84, called NABA, you know, down near Doraville. And I decided to really get serious with this program. And I didn't care. I mean, I cared about all these other priorities in my life, but I made that the number one priority in my life. And my life began to change. And the changes weren't on the outside. The changes were on the inside. I got a sponsor, and this sponsor was a hard ass, and he didn't let me do it my way. There was a morning meeting down there that began at 7:30 in the morning. They called it the early morning study group. It was a pretty cool meeting. It was a literature-based. Every day was different kind of literature. And he wanted me there at 6 o'clock in the morning, making coffee, making connections, because I wasn't a very connected guy. I was a very disconnected guy back in 99. Going out, making connections with people. He wanted me to become a part of the group, get a home group, become active in the home group. I had to be secretary of that home group, and it's like, first of all, secretary is too low a position for me, man. I need a much bigger position than secretary, and that's for women anyway, So he made me eat some, and I learned a lot about myself in that home group. I had all these great ideas that these people just didn't listen to, And it's like, what am I going to do when these people don't listen to my ideas, And how can they not believe this is such a great idea, And I just had to straighten this group out, And I learned a lot about acceptance. I learned a lot about how to get along with other people. And I also began to learn, and this is one of the most important things, I've learned more spiritually from my losses or from the failures in my life than I have from anything I'd succeed at. Because I succeeded with the same kind of self-reliance and, But my failures forced me to look again at the way I was living my life. In my failures, the two biggest failures I've had in my life have absolutely been the things in that have been the biggest growth vehicles for me spiritually. The first one is my addiction, and the second is the failure of my marriage. And that's not like I'm not up here, so happy that my marriage has failed, but the fact that I went through that, and on the other side of it, I have these three great kids, and I've got an ability to relate to them in a new way, and I've still got a decent relationship, with the person that I was married to for almost 20 years, and I'm able to see things differently than I was when I first walked in here. I really believe that that this program is all about changing on the inside. And it is about applying these principles in all of my affairs. It is a way of life, And it's not just a little hobby, as Claude likes to remind us all. It is about what I do when I wake up in the morning, and what kind of disciplines do I have in my life, and where am I going to take myself with these disciplines? I've learned so much about who I am by working the steps. Okay, and the steps to me are really simple. If I really believe that I can't do it myself, and I believe that drugs and alcohol aren't the answer, and I believe that all this other material stuff isn't the answer, the right relationship, the right house, fill in the blank, I would be happy if, and then you fill in the blank. That stuff doesn't work for me, okay? But there is this idea of a higher power, and this higher power really wants for me, an incredibly good life. Now, it's not a life about getting what I want, but it's a life about trying to be of some service to him. And as I try to be of some service to him, what I'm really forced to do is to begin to look at what are the things that are blocking me from that relationship. And that's really where a lot of the step work has come in for me. How do I remove those things that are blocking me from that relationship? And if I really say that this, is the way I want to live, what am I willing to do? I like to say, if I really want to know what I believe, look at what I do. That'll be the way I can really tell you what I believe. I can sit here and say whatever I'm saying, but if I'm not living it, then I really believe in my heart something different than what I'm saying. Damon's got a great CD that he gave me recently, and I love this little story. It's from a father, a priest. His name is Father Gavin, and he's got a great way. I've said this in the beginner's meeting, so those of you that have heard it can, not pay attention here. But the story's it's a quick little story. So he tries to differentiate between what is belief and what is trust. And I think that's at the heart of this program. Am I really trusting, this process, this higher power, etc.? So the story goes something like this. You go into a circus. There's a trapeze artist. And you make a commitment that you're going to go to this circus every day for the next, we'll say it, 90 days. Go for the next 90 days. And over that next 90 days, just like coming to a meeting for 90 days, you see that guy go every day from one side of the high wire to the other side of the high wire. And at the end of 90 days, and by the way he's doing that is he's got a little wheelbarrow, you know, just to make it a little more interesting, and he's pushing that wheelbarrow from the start over to the finish. And so, you know, you make the statement at the end of that 90 days, you say, I believe he is going to get from that point over to that point. You believe that. And that's belief. Now, trust is jumping in the wheelbarrow. Trust is jumping in the wheelbarrow. You know, and that's what this program, I can come here for 90 days or however much time, and I can pay attention and I can hear some good stuff, and actually I can feel better when I walk out of here. I really can. And I can delude myself into thinking that I've really made some changes in my life. But if I haven't got a sponsor, if I haven't worked the steps, if I haven't gotten involved in a home group, my suspicion is the patterns that I've got in my life are going to be, they're not easy to change. And these beliefs that I've got are, you know, they're kind of ironclad if I don't really begin to really chip away at them. And I need the help of something more than just coming in here. I got to begin to really work this thing, and this idea of a higher power beginning to penetrate is key. And so I think this idea of trust, and I believe that the program, you know, and I really, the longer I'm here, the more convinced how little I know. And what I mean by that is there's very little I know about what the right outcomes in my life are supposed to be or in your life are supposed to be. Now, I know a lot about what actions I ought to be taking, because those actions should be guided by some kind of spiritual principle. And when I follow these spiritual principles, then I can begin to rely that the higher power is going to ensure that the outcome is going to be okay. It doesn't matter what the outcome is, but it's going to be okay. And as I experience what I thought were these terrible things like a divorce and addiction, but I see myself getting to the other side of it, I begin to really question, is my judgment about what is good and bad all that good? You know? And maybe I really don't know what's good and bad, you know? And maybe there's a power greater than me that can help me. And maybe this power that's greater than me, you know, that I say I can't trust and rely on, you know, I'm full of crap. I mean, I don't breathe by myself. My heart doesn't beat magically without something taking care of me. So why is it that I, and if you want to go crazy, I've said this before, if you want to go crazy real quick, decide that you want to control your own heartbeat and your own breathing. I can remember when I was really a young kid having a big asthma attack. And man, I was scared to death to go to sleep because I didn't think I was going to survive the night because I had to force myself to breathe. You know, and so this idea that there's not a power taking care of me is incorrect. There really is a power. And now how do I begin to really learn how to trust and rely on it? And as I learn that, I begin to experience a life that's not my own. It's really more of his life. And that life takes on all these new dimensions, all these new things. And I'm telling you, I am at a better place in my life than I've ever been. And I'm not saying I'm perfect and I've got it all figured out. You know, I'm gonna finish with a couple things that mean something to me, and I think they give me a little sense of this is really where I am. It's called contradictions. Have you ever moved in and out of contradiction? What part's truth? What part's fiction? The tick-tock of life beating. Is life gift or obligation? Conscious, sensitive, connected, or callous, self-absorbed, alone. Forgiving, compassionate, loving, or hateful, angry, deceiving, the tick-tock of life beating. Inspired securely or desperately reaching, freely breathing deeply or imprisoned, gasping, wheezing. Awake, open, hopeful, or closed, overwhelmed, choking, the tick-tock of life beating. Swaying, rocking from side to side like a clock ticking, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, the tick-tock of life beating. Stops can be absolutely eternal, but then the clock is rewound. And like an oasis, the stop disappears, lost in a kaleidoscope of beats and stops preceding. Endless change in the midst of never-ending repetition. Endlessly, the tick-tock of life beating, this mysterious rhythm of life, ever reminding us of how little we know. That's me. You know, that's where I am. I mean, I'm not like this perfect human being. I got a tick-tock, man. There's days when I feel really connected. There's days when I don't. But there is a sense that there's a purpose to this, you know. And there's, you know... And I'm going to shut up with one last thing. I went to a funeral. Buzz's sponsor named Ed, and he had this poem. It's an anonymous poem, But if there's a poem that captures what I think my life is supposed to be about, I think this captures it. And it also begins to give me a whole new appreciation for what brokenness is about. Brokenness, I used to think, was this terrible thing for me to avoid. Today, brokenness is the thing that if I'm broken, the light can begin to shine in and change can begin to happen in my life. And it doesn't just happen once. It happens almost on a daily basis. Let me not live a life that's free from the things that draw me close to Thee, for how can I ever hope to heal the wounds of others I do not feel? If my eyes are dry and I never weep, how do I know when the hurt is deep? If my heart is cold and it never bleeds, how can I tell what my brother needs? For when ears are deaf to the beggar's plea and we close our eyes and refuse to see and we steel our hearts and harden our minds and we count it a weakness whenever we're kind, we are no longer following the Father's way or seeking His guidance from day to day. For without crosses to carry and burdens to bear, we dance through a life that is frothy and fair. And chasing the rainbow, we have no desire for roads that are rough and realms that are higher. So spare me no heartache or sorrow, dear Lord. For the heart that is hurt reaps the richest reward. And God enters the heart that is broken with sorrow as He opens the door to a brighter tomorrow. For only through tears can we recognize that suffering that lies in another's eyes. That's all I got. Thanks.